For Arizona Public Media, I'm Fernanda Echavarri, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Coming up, check in with the organizers of this weekend's El Tour de Tucson and find out how they plan to fund the race in future years. Meet the musical group that made the soundtrack for the finale of this year's All Souls Procession. Then, join a group of people in Cochise County trying to restore the plants and animals that previously thrived along waterways now stressed with drought. We'll also meet a middle school math teacher who tries to inspire bilingual students in a new Teacher's Voices segment. Plus, Krista Scheel plays tribute to a film star from Tucson. Those stories are all next here on Arizona Spotlight. After 31 years, El Tour de Tucson is without a title sponsor this week. Britton Eakin speaks to the founder of the event about his love for bicycling and the future of the bicycle event.
Richard DeBernardis started El Tour de Tucson in 1983. It's a bicycling race around the city the Saturday before Thanksgiving every year. Looking back, he says he couldn't have imagined he would still be running El Tour today.
I never intended to go into bicycle event production. It was just a fun thing. I wanted to see if I can do it.
DeBernardis is the president of Perimeter Bicycling Association of America, which organizes El Tour. He discovered bicycling when he worked for the University of Alaska, where he snow-skied between Eskimo villages for work. But he says he never thought about bicycling until a friend suggested it. He was convinced.
May 22nd, 1976, I bought my first bicycle and headed from Alaska to Mexico. And I didn't know anything about bicycling, nothing about, and believe me, I was so afraid of the grizzly bear when I left on May 22nd, because it was 24 hours of light, almost 24 hours, like 23 and a half hours of light, and I didn't want to camp because I was afraid the grizzly were going to come after me.
DeBernardis says he wanted to complete the ride in 40 days.
And I did get there on my 40th day. It was like 2,235 miles, and I'll tell you what, everybody, get on a bicycle and go for a 100-mile or a 1,000-mile bike ride. Bicycle the Pacific Coast. What a beautiful part of the world.
In 1979, DeBernardis rode his bike around the perimeter of the U.S. Then in 1981, he rode more than 6,000 miles on four islands in Japan in 77 days. He describes the experiences he had on his bicycle as profound.
On that bicycle, you deal with all your issues from financial to physical to mental and everything.
DeBernardis says he came to Arizona to train and decided to move here. He then became president of the Greater Arizona Bicycle Association and was asked to put together a small local bike ride. But he says his vision was bigger. He wanted to put together a ride that would give people some of the same benefits he got from riding.
Not everyone's going to be able to bicycle the edge in the United States. I mean, that's a big commitment, giving up 6 months of your life. But if I can give people some of the feelings and the experiences I had on the edge of the United States in a small ride of 110 or 111 miles, then I feel I could do something good for somebody.
And that is how El Tour de Tucson was born. This year, DeBernardis says more than 8,000 people registered for El Tour, and 45% of them are from Pima County. During the week before the ride, some of the local bike shops start buzzing with riders gearing up for the event. At Bear Wheel Bikes in Tucson, some local residents, like Ignacio de Rivera de Rosales, bring their bikes in before the race for a tune-up. He is head of the local El Grupo youth cycling team. For the last 5 years, he's led the team on the 100-mile ride. He says the team's focus isn't competition.
So this year I've got 25 kids riding in it, and I have three different groups. So I've got a group riding the 100, a group riding the 80, and a group riding the 60. And those groups' jobs is to ride together the whole way as a team unit. And I think the camaraderie that comes out of it, not only within my kids, but also with town and with everyone coming from outside of town, is my favorite part.
El Tour almost didn't happen last year because of last-minute problems with the road barricade contractor. DeBernardis says his organization hired five other barricade companies instead, which drove the cost up nearly $60,000. On top of the debt that created, University of Arizona Medical Center's six-year title sponsorship contract expired. That made raising money even more challenging. And he says for the second year in a row, he feared the ride might not happen.
I went to the county manager and just said, you know, this is amazing. After 30 years, I don't think I can go on. We just don't have the money.
The county and the city of Tucson both doubled their contributions this year, giving about $50,000 each. El Tour also got some brand new sponsors, and some existing sponsors gave more money.
We went to some of our sponsors who couldn't afford the title sponsorship level, but they said, why don't we give you an extra $10,000 or an extra $20,000?
Without that funding, DeBernardis says this year's race could have been canceled, but he's still unsure of funding for future years.
I mean, of course, I'm getting on in years, and I won't be able to do this forever, but I want it to stay. I want my children to go on like we all do. And so that's the next battle right now. How are we going to do it next year?
DeBernardis says his organization might have to raise entry fees going forward, or repeat this year's strategy of raising money without a title sponsor. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Britton Eakin. A Tribe Called Red is a DJ crew from Canada. The group produces a unique sound that fuses traditional powwow drums and vocals with cutting-edge electronic music. The members of the group recently visited Tucson and provided the soundtrack for the grand finale at the All Souls Procession. In the span of just a few years, A Tribe Called Red has become the face of urban Native American youth. It is credited with promoting the members' heritage and highlighting Aboriginal cultures. The members also keep up with popular music, fashion, and art. In this next piece, we hear from A Tribe Called Red members, DJ Shub, DJ Indian, and DJ Bear Witness.
Definitely super excited about being part of this event. Hearing a lot about it before we came, and then getting here and hearing the stories about how it started. And just seeing the way that the whole community here really has embraced it and it's become like sort of like an integral part of this city. You know, I think that's really interesting into itself, and excited to participate.
My name is Dan General. I go by DJ Shub, and I am Upper Cayuga from the Six Nations.
Bear Witness. Hugo, also from Six Nations.
Hi, I'm DJ Indian, also known as Ian Compo. All we really did was mash up dance music with dance music, because the powwow music is made for like specific dances and made for, you know, specific regalia. You know, it's made to make you dance. So all we really did was mash up dance music with dance music.
We stick to just powwow music, right? We're not even really remixing, you know, music from individual nations and stuff like that. We're just going strictly for powwow. And when we're talking about powwow music as something that's celebrated across North America, that's a fairly recent tradition for most nations, right? Like powwow, something that came from the prairies, and like people in the prairies had powwows, like, you know, way back. But for something that everybody celebrates, I mean, that's from the 60s, 70s that tradition became so widespread across North America. So we're dealing with something that is a recent tradition, and something that has always been willing and open to integrating modern elements as they came about. Definitely have managed to cross a lot of age barriers. Like, it's definitely been accepted across generations. You know, we hear stories where it'll be like the grandpa of a family who's turned on his daughter to it or son to it, and then turned the grandkids on it. And then we've also heard it go the other way, go from like the grandkids all the way up to grandparents. So, you know, I think we are speaking to all generations, at least part of all generations.
Hey, put the knife down. Put the knife down. Put the knife down.
I think there's a reason why we're doing what we're doing right now. You know, that I think like 10 or 15 years ago, we wouldn't have been able to do this. It wouldn't have been something that the community would have supported, and we probably would have run into more problems. But I think it was the time for it to happen. You know, it was what people were ready for, what people needed and wanted to see happen.
He was not enthusiastic. We're waiting to hear more about what led to a deadly shooting in the city part of downtown Seattle tonight. A man was shot and killed near the intersection of Bourne.
There's a lot. I think that the overriding message is just about representation and representing our culture in the way that we want to see it represented. It goes against the long history of misrepresentation of Aboriginal people in the media. It goes right back to portraiture painting and photography and all of those things where we've never been in control of our own image. So I think if anything, that would be the overriding thing, is just being able to represent our people and our community in a way that we want to be seen.
A video of A Tribe Called Red's performance at the All Souls Procession finale is posted on the Arizona Spotlight page at azpm.org. Coming up, Patagonia residents try to help their native plants and migrating animals cope with drought in riparian areas along waterways. That's next on Arizona Spotlight. Welcome back to Arizona Spotlight. Patagonia, Arizona has declared itself the pollinator capital of the country. It's a pit stop for bees and for migrating butterflies and birds. But the native vegetation that attracts those creatures is threatened by drought and decreasing soil quality. One group of residents and scientists has been working to bring green growth and water back to the area. Mariana Dale has the story.
Every Wednesday at 7 a.m., Patagonia's local Java joint, Gathering Grounds, becomes an open meeting room for the Borderlands Restoration Group. Topics discussed over hot coffee and breakfast include native grasses and the local sparrow population. Ron Pulliam is the group's founder.
See, what we're hoping is that 50 years from now that this meeting will still be going on and people will be talking about, Do you realize that it used to be a time when our creeks didn't run here, and when we still had no forest down along the riparian corridor, and when the wildlife wasn't back?
Pulliam is also a retired professor who taught at the University of Georgia's Odom School of Ecology before moving to Patagonia. He worked in Arizona in the 1970s. When he returned, the changes he saw in the environment surprised him.
A lot of what I saw was very discouraging. I saw places where I knew that streams and rivers had been flowing that were dry. I saw riparian forests, which were skeletons of trees that had died.
Patagonia and its surrounding area are part of the Sky Islands. The region bridges the gap between the tropical environment in central Mexico and the more temperate regions in the north. The range in elevation and climate make it one of the most biologically diverse areas in the country. Here's how University of Arizona scientist Greg Garfin describes it.
We have these kind of oasis environments where we have intermittent or even perennial rivers like the San Pedro. And of course, that also adds to biodiversity. It allows us to live and thrive in the region.
Garfin and his colleagues recently published a study of climate change in the Southwest. They estimate temperatures could rise at least 5 degrees by mid-century. Less certain, but still possible, is decreased precipitation. He says riparian areas adjacent to water sources are also subject to changes from the human population.
The headache for people who are trying to manage these riparian areas is that in some ways it doesn't matter whether it's drought or other groundwater pumping. It's the combination of those things that's making the environments less sustainable.
Garfin says adaptations to the environment, like those spearheaded by Borderlands Restoration, are one way to prepare. The group has been working in the area for about 3 years, and founder Ron Pulliam says its public meetings started last year.
But we're working essentially all over southeastern Arizona, bringing back streams, bringing back forest, revegetating areas, and doing a lot of scientific work as well.
The group makes a little money from events such as plant sales, with most of what it earns going back into the organization. Borderlands Restoration has earned grants from the Bureau of Land Management and the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, in addition to other donors. One spot for several restoration projects is Kate Tyrion's sprawling Patagonia property. Tyrion explains soil degradation in the area as she walks along Bone Creek, one of several small intermittent waterways. She's a permaculturist who practices sustainable environmental design.
And the soils are like butter with a chainsaw when they in this kind of landscape. It doesn't take much to undo them.
In some places, the steep sides of the creek have crumbled, leaving the twisted roots of grasses and trees exposed. The solution? Berms and gabions. The dam-like structures are made from rock chunks enclosed in wire caging.
The idea is to slow the flows down and to stabilize the stream bed. And to actually, we're working on lifting up the stream bed over time by just letting the water itself do the work.
Tyrion says it's a slow process. Even with the new structures, one creek ran dry for the first time in more than 8 years. Restoring water flow is the first step. Next is the vegetation. Earlier this year, Patagonia dubbed itself the pollinator diversity capital of the U.S. Southern Arizona claims up to 600 species of native bees and 300 types of butterflies and moths, according to members of the group. Some of the populations have been on the decline. Borderlands Restoration hopes if it provides more food sources in the form of native plants, the pollinators will return. Caleb Weaver moved to Patagonia and joined the group after graduating from the UA, where he studied geology and ecology.
As they're migrating through, they gotta stop and eat. Same with us when we're traveling around. They don't necessarily have a cooler full of beer in the back or whatever they're eating. So they've got to stop and have some places to eat. So we're trying to create a little patchwork of places that they can do that.
In October, the group held its final planting of the year. Horsetail milkweed, a monarch butterfly favorite, and Indian blanket flower, with large yellow and red blooms that attract bees, were planted near a dry creek bed. According to Weaver, they introduced more than 2,600 plants in the last year, all grown from seed. Each plant is tagged and monitored for growth and flowering and whether it attracts wildlife. The small staff relies on volunteers from the community to accomplish much of the work. First-time volunteer Sarah Hines helped with the replanting.
I'm very impressed with how many people are connected to the plants, and I think most of all impressed with the level of concern about preservation, but with a lack of anger, just with real focus on trying to make things better instead of focusing on being angry about people's ignorance in the past and up to today.
It's been about a month since the group's last planting. Ravenous grasshoppers devoured most of the leaves, but the hope is that tough roots will be able to push up new growth in the spring. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Mariana Dale.
In association with Tucson Values Teachers, Arizona Public Media presents Teachers' Voices. Math can be hard enough for some students to learn without trying to do it in two languages. Arnulfo Velázquez says teaching at a school where most students are bilingual challenges him to be creative. He's a math teacher at Roskridge Middle School and uses pop culture to adapt his curriculum for students who speak two languages.
When students don't know English language well, They're learning the language, and they have to take a difficult test such as AIMS to measure the level of achievement. Then they get in trouble. In other words, the test becomes a language test for many of them. I work in a middle school here in town. Most of the students, if not all of them, are bilingual. To serve those students and to make our math education an enriched experience for them, we need to use both languages and alternate during the week or during the day. Our students use computers a lot. They watch TV for long hours. They listen to music. They like dancing. So if we manage to use music, for instance, into the mathematics instruction, that seems to be very powerful and very engaging for the students. In particular, I've been having a lot of positive experiences using music for them to remember the order of operations. I use La Bamba, for instance. And so if I say, para seguir el orden, para seguir el orden de las operaciones se necesita. And then I go to multiplicación, multiplicación, luego división, lo que veas primero. So I use the music, I play the guitar, and so that becomes something festive, interesting, engaging, and they are learning mathematics right there without even noticing it, and they remember forever. You need to listen to them. You need to know what they like, how their life is like, because many times when you go and investigate on their what we call funds of knowledge that they bring from home, that they bring from their communities, then your lesson plans all of a sudden become something very different. I mean, if you know that your students love going to Peter Piper Pizza, for instance, and that they want to win tickets and play the games and all that, and you make a lesson with all that, all of a sudden they are like, I know the place, I've been there. And if you do this and you do that, you win more tickets, and 20 tickets times five times, and then you start using the mathematics in a real context for them, and then you're still solving the problems. You're still solving the mathematics, and they're learning the mathematics in a much more effective way, in a much more long-lasting way as well, because that's the problem that we have many times.
There are many more Teachers' Voices stories online at azpm.org. Actor Lee Marvin was 63 years old when he died in Tucson a quarter century ago. He was born in New York and is buried in Arlington National Cemetery. Marvin is one of a number of film stars who moved to Tucson after filming here. Film writer Krista Scheel remembers Marvin's notable roles on the silver screen.
The biggest film star who called Tucson his home was, without a doubt, Lee Marvin. After shooting a film here called Pocket Money, Marvin fell in love with the place and moved to Tucson with his family in 1975. He loved the people here, the weather, and working on the landscape of his house in the foothills. Sometimes he could be found having breakfast at a little diner in Casas Adobes Plaza near Oracle and Ina. He was always approachable, and at the same time, Tucson fans respected his need for privacy and didn't crowd him too much. He died too young at age 63 of a heart attack in 1987. Today I pay tribute to this marvelous actor. Born in New York and a decorated veteran from the Pacific War, Marvin got into acting kind of by accident. He was a plumber on a job at a community theater when he was asked to fill in for a performer who was ill. 6'2", with silvery hair and a deep, rough voice, like the purring of a tiger, he was perfectly suited for bad guy parts, heavies, as they called them in the industry. That and tough guy supporting roles of one sort or another is how he was cast in the 50s. The breakthrough came as one of the meanest villains ever seen on film, in Fritz Lang's sensational 1952 crime film, The Big Heat. One of the best film noirs, it stars Glenn Ford as a detective out to beat a crime syndicate that was responsible for the death of his wife. Marvin plays a sadist who puts cigarettes out on one woman and throws scalding coffee in the face of another. The raging fury of the performance, the sense of power gone completely out of control, was something new in a screen villain. Marvin's fame got another boost the same year with The Wild One, in a supporting role with Marlon Brando as Motorcycle Hoods. It was less important as a film and more as a milestone and a new bad boy masculine image exemplified by Brando. A much better film was Bad Day at Black Rock from 1955, directed by John Sturges, in which Spencer Tracy outwits a bunch of men who had murdered a Japanese-American. It also featured Robert Ryan, Ernest Borgnine, and Walter Brennan. The film's anti-racist message was important in its time, and Marvin shared a liberal political viewpoint with Tracy and Ryan. Lee Marvin did lots of TV work along with movies. He was one of the more hard-working actors in the business. In the late 50s, he starred in a police drama called M Squad, playing a tough Chicago detective who heads an elite crime unit. It ran 3 seasons and was quite popular. And it also paved the way for Marvin to make the transition from film-heavy to starring roles as heroes, or in many cases, anti-heroes. But one last great villain role awaited him, the part of Liberty Valance in John Ford's 1962 film, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. His character is the third in a symbolic trio of John Wayne, representing the romantic freedom of the Old West, James Stewart as the new spirit of law and order, and himself, of course, as the dark side of the West, the lawlessness that threatens everything. It's a kind of summing up of John Ford's Western themes, and although many might argue with me, I think Marvin's performance, like a storm wreaking havoc on the ordered lives of all around him, is the most interesting in the film. The 60s were when Marvin came into his own. Among my favorites are his coldly methodical hitman wearing a business suit in Don Siegel's The Killers from 1964, the real villain in that picture played by none other than Ronald Reagan, and the implacable anti-hero of John Borman's Point Blank from 67, out to take down a corporate crime outfit single-handedly. In Point Blank, Marvin perfected that burning stare that turns into something almost tender. Of the modern revenge sagas, One Man Against the System, it was the first, really, and its successors have never matched the sense of loneliness Marvin brought to the lead role. He won a Best Actor Oscar for playing a drunken gunfighter in Cat Ballou, a Jane Fonda Western parody, a little too cute for its own good, but worth seeing just for him. Then he reached superstar status with his lead role in the enormously popular war film The Dirty Dozen. There are really too many good films for me to mention, but there was an artistic peak of sorts in 73 when he played Hickey in Eugene O'Neill's The Iceman Cometh, with Frederick March, Robert Ryan, and the young Jeff Bridges. People forget that he excelled on the Broadway stage as well. Here, his portrayal of the righteous convert to sobriety with a dark past is arguably the best on record. And in 1980, he was the lead in Samuel Fuller's World War II epic The Big Red One. The film was marred by a low budget and studio interference, but it remains a brutally unromantic portrait of the war in Europe. Marvin had been a soldier, and he knew there was nothing glorious about war. In The Big Red One, he brought all the sadness and dignity he knew to the part of the sergeant, the man who must try to keep going and keep his men alive. I'm glad I could spend these few minutes appreciating a great actor and Toussonan. And many thanks to Lee Marvin's stepdaughter, Wendy King, for agreeing to talk and provide a glimpse of the man. For Arizona Spotlight, this is Chris DeShiel.
Thank you for listening to Arizona Spotlight. This show originates from the Arizona Public Media Radio Studios and was produced by Andrea Kelly. The production engineer is Jim Blackwood. The music is by Calexico. Funding for Teachers' Voices is provided in part by Cox Communications and the University of Arizona College of Education. I'm your host, Fernanda Echavarri, in for Mark McLemore.